Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you agree with people on the left when they say religion does not belong in politics or the discussion of social issues or the making of public policy. Well, my friend, if you agree with the left on that issue, then we have a paradox because actually the left disagrees with you. They talk about religion all the time, and who better to represent the left than the man who embraces socialism and wealth redistribution while getting rich off of capitalism? Michael Moore, with a net worth of $50 million, believes in wealth redistribution. Now, I don't want to depress you today. I really don't. So before talking about Michael Moore, who probably will depress you, let me introduce today's co-host, because she never depresses anybody. Say hello to Dana Wright.
Oh, well, I hope not. I don't want to depress anybody ever, but I am supposed to be a rotating co-host, and this is kind
and this
of
is three for
this
three.
Is three, three in a row.
Where's the rotation,
so
Dana?
Well, we're gonna finish this up.
Everyone's been hearing me invite you back again.
I know. So we really will finish up this series.
We do have a few other rotating co-hosts.
We do, and you actually have one of them coming up in a few weeks. Mark Boubian, your movie critic.
Yes, you're a little prettier than Mark. And I can
don't tell
tell
Mark
you
that.
Quite categorically that my
Mark not
will not mind that I said that. Believe me.
He would be more in the handsome category. All righty.
I'm not even calling him that.
I would. Goodness.
Oh, I'm not saying he's a bad looking guy. I'm just saying that guys don't go around calling other guys handsome.
Okay,
well,
that's true.
Some do, but we won't get into that today. That's not today's topic.
That is not today's. And I do know you're having Mark come on soon.
He's going to come on because around Academy Awards time,
you guys
we talk about the
show.
Movies that were nominated. And he hates the Academy Awards. And I like them more than he does. But we usually agree that a lot of times movies that should have won or movies that were ignored and weren't even nominated didn't get on the list. So it gives us a chance to kind of review what we thought the best movies of the year were.
And I know you do homework. And,
well, you
have to go to the movies.
See, when you have
a
radio show and you know you're going to go to the movies, then even my day off, where I'll usually go to a movie, if I'm going to see a movie that I know I'm going to talk about it for the show, it's kind of like a day off, but it's a little bit like work because I'm studying it and
mixing
like that.
Work
with a pleasure awesome. Of a big box of buttered popcorn. Yes.
Well, I'm going to give you a little bit of a chance to talk about a few of them before we get on for Mark. One of them I know isn't one that's a nomination, but Exodus, Gods and Kings, I know
yes.
you saw.
Well, boy, I guess, Dana, once in a while the Academy gets it right. Exodus, Gods and Kings, to my knowledge, was not nominated for anything, and boy, it didn't deserve to be. Now, it's got a pretty fair director, Ridley Scott. He made the movie Alien. There were creepier things in this movie than Alien. Exodus is the story of Moses. And of course, a lot of Christians were wondering, is he going to go in there and say that this stuff never happened? You know, kind of like, well, is it going to be like, no, well, actually, this guy was talking about the plagues of Egypt. And in the story, the plagues happened. And in the story, the Red Sea did part. But a lot of people wouldn't recognize this, but because of my studies of the Bible, I'm very familiar with liberal scholarship. And there's a scholar who years ago, even back when I was in college taking religious studies classes, this guy named Velikovsky, he was coming out with theories that if a comet came close to the Earth, it would throw off the natural cycle of things, and it could infest the Nile. And then if the Nile got infested, we might get flies and gnats, and then the frogs might leave. And see, when people come up with these naturalistic explanations, I'm looking at this saying, look, if you don't believe in miracles, fine. You don't believe in miracles. Why not just admit that you don't believe in the Bible? Isn't it interesting that people feel the need to respect the Bible enough to make it fit? And then you hear things like, well, it was natural for the winds to just blow the water back a little bit at this certain place along the coast of Egypt. But the Bible says that the water was big enough and deep enough that the Hebrews went on dry land, that when the Egyptian charioteers went into the dry land after them, when the water closed up, it drowned them. And these little beaches where the wind does sometimes push back the water, they're talking about water that's only a few feet high. It makes no sense. The movie's called Exodus Gods and Kings. I call it Exodus Directors and Idiots.
Oh,
now,
my.
They have this kid as God. Now, the Bible does say that sometimes God takes on the form of a man. Of course, in the New Testament, we've been talking about this a lot the last couple of weeks as we've been talking about being made in the image of God. God did come as a man, named himself Jesus. But even before Jesus came, we had in the Old Testament what we would call pre-incarnate appearances of Christ, where sometimes a person would talk to a man. And there's even this person known as the angel of the Lord. When we think of angel, we think of somebody with wings. But when Moses talked to God at the burning of bush, it actually said it was the angel of the Lord who talked to him. The angel of the Lord, it seems, was what the New Testament calls God the Word. The Old Testament called God the Messenger. Angel just literally means messenger. Second person of the Trinity, God the Word, God the Messenger, became flesh, became God the Son in the incarnation. In the pre-incarnation, sometimes God, through this messenger, through his angel, spoke to people. So what, all to say that if they wanted to, somewhere in the movie, say that somebody who looked like a man stood in front of Moses, I wouldn't have had that much of a problem with that. As far as it goes, it's not that far up, but they made him this little kid. This creepy little, whiny little kid who looked like he couldn't have been more than 7 or 8 years old. He looked like a spoiled little brat. He talked like a spoiled little brat. And when Moses asked him how the Nile was going to turn to blood, he said something like, well, just you wait and see. And you know how the Nile turned to blood? All these crocodiles started attacking people in boats, and they started eating all these people. And this was God showing his judgment, and that's how the water turned. It was creepy. Now, when it started off, it wasn't that bad. The acting wasn't that bad. The dialogue wasn't that bad. For the first half hour, I was thinking, boy, this might be pretty good. I thought I was going to be pleasantly surprised, but it just turned out to be another dumb Hollywood movie. I'll give it a little bit of a kudo that, unlike Hollywood, they didn't just come out and say these things never happened, but the way they tried to explain it happening, ugh. Give me Charlton Heston and the Ten Commandments, movies the way the good Lord intended them to be made. Give me those any day of the week.
So it sounds like it's good. That one did not get any nominations.
Yeah, you did. And I got to agree with the Academy this time. Boy, good thing they didn't nominate that piece of, well, we're on the radio, so I won't say.
Yes, you want to keep that going. Oh. And I know you did see Selma, which been nominated.
Selma was nominated, and Selma's the story of Martin Luther King. Now, we've been talking a lot about what's been going on in this country where wannabe Martin Luther Kings like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, who are not cut from the same cloth at all, who are race baiters and not uniters like Martin Luther King was. So I was interested to see, because sometimes, Dana, what they'll do in Hollywood is they'll go back to a time when, I mean, obviously, as long as you have human beings, you're going to have some racist somewhere. But we don't have the institutionalized racism, slavery, segregation, Jim Crow laws that we used to have. Sometimes people will go back to a time like the 50s and 60s with King, of course, we're talking about the 60s, and they'll look at that and then extrapolate from there that the same problems still exist. I was expecting that in this movie, but I was very pleasantly surprised. Here again, pleasantly surprised. When the movie finally ended, I said, this was a good movie. It was a good portrayal of Martin Luther King. I've heard that there's a few historical inaccuracies. I've heard this secondhand. I haven't had a time to look into it, but there was some complaint about the way Lyndon Johnson had been portrayed. But all in all, I really liked it. I thought it was a very good movie, and I could not wait to tell people how good it was. And then, when the movie ended, and they rolled the credits, a rapper came on. You're hearing the rapper while you're watching the credits, and he's rapping about Ferguson and the policemen of Ferguson. And that showed me that they did turn this into an agenda movie. And I'm sorry if that was approved by the director, and I assume it was, then what would have been a good movie, I have to say, was a bad movie, because the police officer in Ferguson that shot that guy shot a thug, shot somebody who had held up a store, shot somebody who attacked him. He was exonerated. He went before a grand jury. African-American witnesses came forth and exonerated the police officer. And that didn't matter to Al Sharpton, and that didn't matter to our miserable excuse for an attorney general, Eric Holder, who decided to launch his own investigation. And eventually the FBI investigation cleared him too. The Department of Justice did. But it just makes my head spin. It boils my oil that I believe Martin Luther King would be turning in his grave over this. And what a shameful way to depict them. It's a shame. It was a good movie. And then they rolled the credits. And just in those seconds I was watching the credits, those credits with the rapper turned a good movie into a bad movie. And that's my review of Selma.
Okay. How about American Sniper?
Well, that one's being talked about a lot. That's probably the one everybody expects us to talk about the most. I thought American Sniper was a very good movie. There's so much controversy back and forth about it. It seemed to me that Clint Eastwood was taking a position somewhat in the middle. He seems more conservative these days, Clint Eastwood. I mean, he actually spoke at the convention of the Republicans on behalf of Romney. But it seemed to me that American Sniper, well done, well acted, good dialogue, fairly good character development. I would have liked to have known a little more about the characters. These days, I could do with a little less action, but the action was very well done. And it showed a person who was, of course, as a sniper, helping the Americans. He was hiding himself up on rooftops to keep Americans from being ambushed, and so he'd snipe them. When we think of a sniper, we usually think of some paid assassin, some evil person. This was a person who had the right motive. And throughout the movie, he never regretted what he did, but she still saw that having killed that many people, even for a righteous cause, was having an effect on him. So for those who don't like war, you could say that this movie certainly showed you the downside of war. But on the other hand, for those who say there are some things worth fighting for, they would have liked it too. But it's really interesting the kind of bad press this movie is getting from the left. It did get nominated for Best Picture by Hollywood. I don't know how that happened. I have a feeling it's not going to win one single award because I think Hollywood's getting a bad name from its leftist critics. But I thought it was a pretty good movie, and I didn't think that Clint Eastwood was trying to make this hawkish pro-war message, but I did think he was just giving us a slice of life, a slice of Americana, a piece of history about a very well-intentioned man who, whatever your view of the war was, he at least believed he was doing the right thing, never regretted it, but it did take its toll on him. If you kill that many people for whatever reason, it's going to start affecting you. It's going to start affecting your wife. It's going to start affecting your kids.
Right.
So it was showing the effect. Dana. How did you come away?
I thought it was definitely a glimpse into how soldiers psychologically change as they're in these really difficult situations. You could see the difficulty in trying to function as a husband and a father when he was home. Each tour he came home and he was more and more distant, and his shifting into being driven to be a part of that force and do his job and protect the country. You know, it just, you can see how hard it is for these soldiers to go off and do this difficult job and then come home and try to function in civilization.
Absolutely. Now, regarding this movie, Michael Moore commented on it too. And this returns me to what I mentioned at the top of the show. Never one to shy away from stating his opinions and convictions, Michael Moore did weigh in on this very popular, very controversial Clint Eastwood film, American Sniper. In a recent tweet, Moore said, and I quote, "Tomorrow's Sunday school. What would Jesus do? Oh, I know what he'd do. Hide on top of a roof and shoot people in the back."
Hmm.
Little bit of sarcasm from Michael Moore. Of course, the Bible draws a distinction, a very clear distinction, between cold-blooded murder and killing as a means of protecting others from evil. But while people are perfectly free to debate both ethics and the interpretation of Scripture, I think Michael Moore's consistency, or lack thereof, is the real issue here. Dana, it's not difficult to imagine how Moore would respond if a conservative asked what Jesus would say about the issue of abortion. Or if a conservative said, well, what would Jesus say about same-sex marriage, both of which are forbidden in the same Bible where Moore supposedly deciphers Jesus' view of snipers. When the Supreme Court ruled against the Defense of Marriage Act, Moore called it a huge victory. As for abortion, Moore is also on record. This is what Moore said about abortion, and he didn't seem to be going with the biblical view. Moore said, human life begins when the fetus can survive outside the womb. Some people, I guess, just like to be the uterus police, the bossy pants of other women's reproductive parts. Mm. And that has always struck me as really, really weird. So, of course, the geography of the baby is what determines whether the baby's up. Now, if Moore sounds like he's cherry-picking his Jesus causes, keep in mind that this is nothing unusual. He simply figured out the rules. When the cause is liberal, invoking the Bible is fair game. When the cause is conservative, religion does not belong in the discussion. Now, Moore is in good company. Last fall, I did a whole program about the relationship between religion and politics. And at that time, I talked about some recent statements of John Kerry. John Kerry saw the Bible as an ally on the issue of climate change. Kerry said, for many of us, respect for God's creation also translates into a duty to protect and sustain his first creation, Earth, the planet. Confronting climate change is, in the long run, one of the greatest challenges that we face. And you can see this duty or responsibility laid out in scriptures clearly, beginning in Genesis. Of course, Genesis says nothing about climate change or global warming, but I don't think John Kerry ever confused anybody with facts. And during his 2004 presidential election, candidate for president John Kerry didn't seem to think that religion should be related to public policy. Instead, he retired and recited that drivel about being personally against abortion while remaining pro-choice as a public position. And in an interview with the Telegraph Herald, Kerry said, I oppose abortion personally. I don't like abortion. I believe life does begin at conception, but I can't take my Catholic belief, my article of faith, and legislate it on a Protestant or a Jew or an atheist who doesn't share it. We have separation of church and state in the United States of America. Translation. He believes that life begins at conception, which means he believes abortion is murder. But as a public servant, he will do nothing to oppose such murder because that would bring religion into the mix. And yet, during this very same election year, while courting the African-American vote in a speech at Friendship, Missouri Baptist Church, Friendship Missionary Baptist Church, I should say, in Liberty City, Florida, Kerry quoted from the Bible saying, faith without works is dead. He also said, when I look around me in this country, I see a whole bunch of people who talk about faith. I see a whole bunch of people who put it out there, but I see an awful lot of deeds undone. I see a lot of work to be done in this country. Getting more specific, Kerry included civil rights as part of the religious cause. What's on the ballot is the American dream. What's on the ballot is what Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton marched for. We have an unfinished march in this nation. Of course, no discussion of political consistency would be complete without the words of Nancy Pelosi. While speaking to the Catholic Community Conference on the issue of illegal immigration, she said, I would hope there's one thing we can do working together as we go forward that speaks to what the Bible tells us about the dignity and worth of every person. And that is on the subject of immigration, because I think the church is going to have to play a very major role in how we and how people are treated. Apparently, the dignity and worth of unborn children is not to be included here, at least it's not as far as any legislation is concerned. Pelosi also a practicing Catholic, parses her stance on abortion between personal conviction and public policy, Justice Carey does. Okay, that's a little bit of a review. I did a whole show on that back in November. But what I want to say today, Dana, despite this glaring hypocrisy, I, as a conservative, would never work against a liberal's right to invoke religion. Erroneous interpretation notwithstanding, all viewpoints and all laws are the result of somebody's standard of morality. If not a biblical standard, it would only be an atheist standard or a humanist standard or perhaps the standard of some other religion. We must not let anybody get away with this nonsensical claim that religious people have less rights to be vocal on social issues or public policy than anyone else. Our forefathers created a law which forbade a mandatory state church. They did not forbid Christians to act out their convictions in the world. It was never their intention to limit religious speech to boundaries within cathedral walls. Religious rights and free speech rights are protected for everybody, including, ironically, bags of wind like Michael Moore, John Kerry, and Nancy Pelosi. This is Bob Siegel, somewhat winded myself, making the obvious obvious.
This is Dana Wright, a reoccurring co-host on The Bob Siegel Show. You only need to listen to this radio program once to figure out that Bob has very strong opinions on a wide variety of issues. But one of Bob's strongest passions is freedom of speech itself, even when such speech challenges his own convictions. So feel free to send Bob a comment or a thought-provoking question. You can reach Bob on Facebook, Twitter, or questions at bobsiegel.net.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539. W&S Electric.
Hi, I'm Dana Wright, here to talk about Bob Siegel's book, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... The title itself is an open-ended question. You fill in the rest. I'd like to believe in Jesus, but... Is there really proof for the resurrection of Christ? How could a loving God send people to hell? How will God judge people who never heard of Jesus? Can a scientific mind really accept miracles? These are but some of the concerns keeping honest seekers from considering Christianity. In an interesting, down-to-earth style, Bob tackles the hardest, most painfully honest questions. Rather than shoving these topics under the rug, Bob shows respect for his readers by providing detailed and compelling explanations. This book has been enjoyed by both skeptics and Christians alike. I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But, by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. And as long as I was just talking to you about Bob's book called I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But, I want to also remind you that just this last week, his fictional book, a children's story, which is even loved by adults, just came out, The Dangerous Christmas Ornament. It was only available last week on ebooks. However, you can now order a printed version as well.
Has arrived.
And the cover is gorgeous.
I can't take credit for the cover. They had a fantastic illustrator.
You did have a great illustrator.
I could not have wanted a better looking cover. And there's some pictures inside the book as well.
There are. And so The Dangerous Christmas Ornament is available now, both ebook and print
and
version.
And I'm kind of excited, but kind of putting myself out there. As you know, for years on this program, with our theme being Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture, a lot of times we do pop culture shows. Film critic Mark Booby and I have been very critical of movies. So now I got something out there that people can criticize. So if you read this and you like it, write a review on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. Write a customer review. If you read it and you don't like it, never mind. Skip it. You don't have to write a review.
Everybody's going to love it. It's a great story that talks about good and evil and has a lot of twists and turns. It's a great story. I absolutely loved it. So go online and order that book. You can also contact Bob lots of different ways. Facebook, Twitter, questions@bobsiegel.net. Those are all ways you can get a hold of him. And we're going to share a couple of things from people who got a hold of Bob. So this first thing is a response to the comment you had about Michael Moore, and it's from Jen. And he says, or she says, Michael Moore is an irrelevant slob. All of a sudden, he found something in the Bible to state, do not give him the right time of day.
Well, Jen, I think, Dana, that what Jen is saying is, why are we even wasting our time talking about him or writing about him? I wrote an article about this, too. And Jen, it's hard sometimes when you read a comment to know what the person's agenda was. Jen, if that's what you meant to say, then assuming that, I somewhat agree with you and I somewhat disagree. On one hand, it's true. These ignorant blowhards should not be taken seriously. On the other hand, people do take them seriously. Michael Moore has won many awards, and politicians like Kerry and Pelosi, who I was also talking about, we have to take them seriously because they make our laws. And so if they make comments that are untrue, if they make comments that are inconsistent, they need to be called out. And of course, I wasn't saying that they shouldn't have a right to talk about religion. I was talking about the inconsistency of people who on one hand say separation between church and state, and on the other hand prove that they don't really mean it. They only believe in that separation when it's a conservative cause, not a liberal cause. They do need to be called out. However, Jen, I'm sure that as far as our sentiments are concerned, you and I are on the exact same page. Thank you for your comment.
The next is a letter from Jack. And Jack starts out talking about hearing your show early Sunday morning, which, just to make sure people understand, it airs live on Sunday evenings.
Right.
However,
now,
if they're hearing it in the morning time, it means it's a replay of
the
week
you and
before.
I are here live right now, but if you're hearing this Sunday morning, you're hearing us a week from now, which means, I guess, while you're hearing us, we're not live. It repeats on KPRZ and KCBQ both, but in the middle of the night on the following weekend. So what he heard was a show from the previous week.
It was a repeat. So Jack says, I was briefly listening to your show early Sunday morning regarding questions that we, as Jehovah's Witnesses, don't have at the time an immediate answer to. We ask the person asking the questions if we can get back to them so we can do some research so as to give them correct reasoning on the subject, and we do say, not necessarily, let me go and talk to the elders. We do the research ourselves. Out of respect for most people, they do agree. As far as avoiding you, is something you brought out. We respect that you are happy with your choice of religion. We are looking for those who are searching and not happy with their religion. We choose not to debate. Sorry, you have been misinformed. Jack goes on to say, as far as Daniel and politics, when the Christian congregation was formed, what did Jesus Christ say when they wanted king, when they wanted Jesus to be king? He said, "My kingdom is not part of this world," a very short version. However, if you would like to know more on this subject, feel free to contact one of the Jehovah's Witnesses. You can go to our website, jw.org, and fill out the section for a free home Bible study, and someone in your area will contact you for a free home Bible study at a place and time convenient for you. Also, look into our section, JW Broadcasting, and watch videos that you might find interesting. Thank you for your time. Sincerely, Jack.
Okay, well, Jack, thank you for writing in. You seem like a very nice person. You seem sincere and friendly. I respect that. But with all due respect, Jack, I must disagree with several key things you said in your letter. First of all, Jack, I have not been misinformed. I know the Jehovah's Witnesses very well. I have been dialoguing with Jehovah's Witnesses at my front door and on college campuses for many, many, many years, ever since I was a college student back in the year 1973. And on the program that you were listening to, Jack, we mentioned an ex-Jehovah's Witness, Christine Schinelli, who had been on our show. We referred to a previous program. I had interviewed her for an entire program in the fall of 2013. That interview is still posted to my website. Are ex-Jehovah's Witnesses uninformed about Jehovah's Witnesses? Now, on to other points you made. Jack, if you yourself, when somebody asked you, because he was making the point, Dana, that I had mentioned that I talked to somebody and he wasn't able to answer my question, so he said he talked to his elders. Right. And he's saying, no, we don't go talk to our elders. We go and do personal research.
Themselves.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
So Jack, if you yourself, when somebody asks you a question that you can't answer, go and do personal research, that's great. That's fantastic. That's exactly what you should do. The gentleman I talked to a number of years ago did not say he was going to do research. He did say that he was going to check with his elders and get back to me. Instead of getting back to me, he refused to talk to me when I saw him 1 week later back on the same campus, UCSD. Jack, you say Jehovah's Witnesses choose not to debate. Let me say this delicately. First of all, if you did choose to debate, there would be absolutely nothing wrong with that. Debates can be carried out in a respectful manner. Debates can be friendly. Debates are not four-letter words, and debates are not unbiblical. Jesus debated with the Pharisees and Sadducees all the time. We read that constantly in the Gospels. And in the book of Acts, we read about a man named Apollos, one of the early Christian leaders. And we read in Acts chapter 18, he argued with the Jews day and night from the scriptures. Now, Jehovah's Witnesses have been debating and arguing with me for years. They also debate and argue with others. Now, Jack, maybe you don't like words such as debate. Maybe you don't like the word argue. But whatever you want to call it, Jack, your very letter was a debate response. You said I was misinformed about things. You sought to clarify the positions you felt I was misrepresenting. You went on to argue against my point that it's okay for Christians to be involved with politics. I'll respond to that point in a moment, but for now, let's be honest, Jack. If it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. Your letter is a rebuttal of some points on my radio show. That is an argument. That is a debate, and it's one you had every right to put forth. I don't agree with your argument, but I respect that you have one. We'll be right back. This is Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. Jesus said that his people should be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. Some churches take that mandate seriously, others, sadly, do not. I am happy to announce that there are many good, serious churches in San Diego, and Skyline is certainly one of them. Outreaches to the community and the world at large are carried on by our missionary family. Their ministries to the poor, the shut-ins, and the emotionally scarred. There are groups and classes for all ages, from children to middle school to high school, college, young adult, and senior citizen. Skyline is also on the cutting edge of today's social issues. We mobilize people and help them to be a better voice for the changing culture around us. Sunday services are at 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock every week. Skyline Church, located at 94 and Hamishaw. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. This is Bob Siegel and Dana Wright. Well, Dana, we were in the middle of a letter from Jack, a Jehovah's Witness, who heard our program where we talked about Jehovah's Witnesses. And he was saying Jehovah's Witnesses don't debate. And I started by saying, well, there's nothing wrong with the debate. Debates are very biblical. Jesus debated. Apollos debated. You certainly see examples of the Apostle Paul debating. And then I mentioned that actually by him saying that I was misinformed, and he was speaking in a friendly way, but he was saying that I was misinformed and he was bringing out points. And so let me just go over that again, Jack. You were putting out points that were very debate-oriented, and you had every right to do that. Once again, I don't agree with what you were saying, but I respect that you have an opinion. I must say, however, I am extending more respect than I have received from Jehovah's Witnesses in the past. I don't mean you personally, Jack. Jack, you say that you respect that I am happy with my choice of religion. Well, Jack, maybe you personally are happy about that. But you said that in your letter on behalf of witnesses. You didn't say, I respect that you are happy. You said, we respect that you are happy. Well, as far as that we, I've never seen it, Jack. Every single Jehovah's Witness I have talked to said that I was not in the true church. A moment ago, we heard a commercial for Skyline Church. That's a church that I go to. If somebody leaves Skyline and goes to another church, I don't tell them that they've lost their salvation. I tell people that Skyline's a good church. I said in the commercial, it's one of many good churches in San Diego. When somebody leaves the Jehovah's Witness church, it's a different story. The woman that I had on my show, Christine Schinelli, she has left the Jehovah's Witnesses. She has been blacklisted by them. They are not allowed to even talk to her. Every ex-Jehovah's Witness who I've ever known, and I've known a few, have told me the exact same story. If Jehovah's Witnesses are happy for people's religious choices, then why aren't they happy for people who leave the Kingdon Hall? Again, Jack, I don't know you. Maybe you personally are happy. I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. But if you are happy for ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, you are in disagreement with your own church leadership. I guarantee that. And if you are talking and speaking with ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, you are in disobedience with your own church leadership. Perhaps you haven't been involved with the Jehovah's Witnesses long enough to know that. I don't know, Jack. But again, I'll trust you. You seem like a nice guy. But I'm just telling you, I've been talking to Jehovah's Witnesses for years. They do not respect the choices that people make unless they're choosing Jehovah's Witnesses. Now, about Christians and politics, since you were also responding to this. Yes, Jesus said his kingdom was of another world. He said that in John 18. He also said he would return someday and rule this world as king. And the gentleman debating me that we were talking about on the previous show, he wasn't arguing against a theocracy anyway. We already had a theocracy in the days of the Old Testament. He was saying that in governments that are not a theocracy, governments that are secular or pagan, God's people, he said, were forbidden to get involved with those governments. And I responded by pointing out that Daniel, as a Jewish prisoner in Babylon, was made second in command of the nation by King Darius. And he said to me that Daniel did that only out of fear of his life. Daniel had no choice. I pointed out that Daniel never compromised his convictions, that when an edict threatened death to any Jew who prayed to God, Daniel was willing to go to the lion's den rather than obey that edict. Therefore, he was not one who would compromise. Therefore, when he served as second in command of Babylon, he was not compromising either. The Babylonians, of course, were actually under the Persian conquest at that time. The gentleman said he would ask his elders about this, and then he would get back to me. Instead of getting back to me, he refused to have any further discussions with me.
Yeah, and Jack actually wrote to you twice, I know, and the second letter, I'm just going to read a portion of it.
Right, because there was only one question. There were other things he said, but there was only one question in the second letter.
So here's
statement, actually.
Okay, so here's what Jack wrote in the second letter, just a portion of it. We are in 236 lands and 110,000 congregations and are one, just as Jesus Christ and his Father are one. 17 chapter of John. As I am very sure you know this chapter very well, I do believe you have the knowledge of God's word.
Well, thank you for saying that, Jack. I appreciate that. And I believe, Dana, he's talking about the amount of congregations and lands that Jehovah's Witnesses are in. I wasn't exactly sure the point he was trying to make here. So, Jack, if I respond to something you weren't trying to say, please forgive me. Jack, I believe the point you're trying to make here is that Christians often, because the other thing Christians argue with Jehovah's Witnesses about all the time is the Trinity. And Christians often talk about Jesus and the Father are one. They'll go to verses where Jesus says, I and the Father are one. And I think, Dana, what Jack's doing here is he's saying, well, yeah, Jesus said he and the Father are one. But in chapter 17, he was praying. He was saying, Father, I pray that my people will be one just as you and I are one. So he's trying to say there's other ways to be one. We're in 236 lands, but we're one. We're in 110,000 congregations, we're one. I think he just meant to say that the oneness between Christ and the Father might be a figure of speech. The only other thing I could figure out that you might have been trying to say, Jack, is that there's a real unity amongst Jehovah's Witnesses, as if that proves something. But all churches have unity within their denominations, so I'm not sure that would really make a whole lot of point. But assuming he meant, and I have at least, I can say I've heard this from other Jehovah's Witnesses, when you say to them, well, what do you do with the verse that says, I and the Father are one? They'll say, oh, well, one in purpose, one in unity. It doesn't mean they're the same God. So let me respond to that, because I do think that's what he meant. And yes, it's true. A word like one in the scripture can mean many things based on the context of the particular verse. And in this particular case, John 17, Jesus is certainly comparing the closeness of people to a closeness that he has with God the Father. But putting this verse in the context of other verses, we learn that Jesus meant something much different regarding the unity he had with the Father. This is not the only time where he said, I and the Father are one. And in the earlier time, John chapter 10, it was explained better. I'm reading from John chapter 10, starting with verse 30. Jesus talking. I and the Father are one. Again, the Jews picked up stones to stone him, but Jesus said to them, I have shown you many great miracles from the Father. For which of these do you stone me? We are not stoning you for any of these, replied the Jews, but for blasphemy, because you, a mere man, claim to be God. You see the point, Dana? By saying I and the Father are one, everybody around Jesus understood that that was a claim to deity. Now, when we talk about the Jews picking up stones, it was the Jewish religious leaders. There was a corrupt priesthood and some corrupt rabbis. They didn't mean all Jews. There were many Jews following Jesus too. So the New Testament wasn't an anti-Semitic book. But claiming that he and the Father are one, what that meant to the original audience is what it truly means. The original audience understood that as a claim to deity.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out his online column, Forbidden Table Talk, published and hosted weekly by Communities Digital News. Bob is also a regular contributor to San Diego Rostra. We invite you to visit Bob's website at www.bobsiegel.net. You can listen to previous radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and find information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. BobSiegel.net.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. This is Bob Siegel and Dana Wright. So Dana, we're wrapping up a letter from Jack. And
yes.
Of course, he's a Jehovah's Witness, and one of their features is they don't believe in the Trinity. Now, one of the things that gets confusing, Dana, when people talk about the Trinity is they say, well, how come Christ called himself the Son of God if he was really God? Again, when we use a word like Son of God in the 21st century, we think, oh, we're all children of God. In those days, and again, I can't repeat this enough, what the Bible, and this is not just true of the Bible, this is true of any ancient literature, this is true of any literature, what the author intended to say, what the original audience understood it to mean, is what it means. We've got to put ourselves in the heads of people in those days, and we happen to know by looking at extra documents outside the Bible, such as the Dead Sea Scrolls, the term Son of God was a very special term and claim of deity. Calling yourself the Son of God by a very special title wasn't the same as saying, oh, we're all children of God. And we can prove that. John 5:18, it says, for this reason, the Jews tried all the harder to kill him. Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own father, making himself equal with God. So when people say, why didn't Jesus call himself God? Why did he call himself the Son of God? I've got two parts of an answer. Part one, calling himself the Son of God was calling himself God. But part two, he also called himself God in so many words, and you couldn't get closer than the name. In John 8:58, there's a very interesting discussion. Jesus is talking about Abraham, the father of the Jews, the patriarch who had lived a long time before. And he's talking about Abraham as if he knew him personally. And so some of the Jews, and again, when they say Jews here, they mean the Jewish religious leaders. There were just as many Jews that were following Jesus. In fact, far more people were following him than opposing him. Big split in the nation of Israel over Jesus at this time. But the religious leaders, they said, you're talking about Abraham, you're not even 50 years old. And you're talking about Abraham as if you knew him. And Jesus said to them, before Abraham was, I am. Now, even in Greek, that would have been bad grammar. I am, ego, eimi. Even in Greek, even in that ancient language, the correct grammar would have been before Abraham was, I was. So why did he say I am? And well, we had heard those words before. When Moses talked to God at the burning bush, and God said, I want you to go to Egypt and tell Pharaoh to let my people go. Well, Moses knew that Pharaoh believed in many gods. He knew Pharaoh was going to get out the yellow pages, look through the catalog of gods, and go, God, God, which God are you referring to? So he said, he's going to ask what your name is. And God said, I am that I am. Tell the Pharaoh, I am has sent you. The name for God is I am. Just in case there's any doubt that that's just exactly what Jesus was claiming, the Jewish leaders picked up stones to stone him. Why were they stoning him? For bad grammar? No, they were stoning him because he claimed to be God. For a Jew to claim to be the God of Israel, for a Jew to claim to be the one and only God of the universe was blasphemy, and he deserved to be stoned to death under the law of Moses. Unless, by chance, he was telling the truth and he happened to really be God. But they didn't believe he was God. What's clear, though, is that they understood just exactly what he was claiming. Jesus claimed to be God. Now, we could say, well, how can he be God? And sometimes people bring in the idea, well, how could he pray? Why did he pray to God if he was God? Because at that time, God, the Word, the second person of the Trinity, had become a man. And as a man, he depended on God. He depended on the other two persons of the Trinity. He emptied himself of the mind of God, the power of God, whatever he looked like as God. He became a real man. And he wasn't saying, look at me, I'm God. He was saying, look at me, I'm God, showing you how a human being should live, not asking you to go through anything I'm not willing to go through myself, and living it out. Anyway, Jack, thank you for writing, my friend. Thank you for listening. And thank you for the very good spirit of which you put out things. I hope I responded in that same spirit. That was certainly my intention. And God bless you on your pilgrimage and your search, Jack.
Thank you, Jack. Bob, I'm going to challenge you that you can finish this series that we've been working on about heaven and paradise and Jesus. And you've got just enough time to close this up.
We don't finish anything around here. Who are
okay,
we kidding?
Okay, well, let's try. Let's skip back to, so how would Jesus have
known?
We
have to try because next week's a repeat broadcast.
Well, there you go.
I couldn't come
so
back.
So here you go. So I know you can do this. How could Jesus have known, how could Jesus not have known everything if he was really God?
Well, like I just said, Jesus emptied himself of the power of God. And so while he was here as a human being, he did empty himself of the mind of God. So when Mary, his mother, was raising him, he wasn't sitting in the high chair thinking, I'm the God of the universe. And now at some point in his life, the other two persons of the Trinity, the Father and the Holy Spirit, revealed to him who he was. But we're told that Jesus as a man was limited both knowledge and in wisdom. Matthew 24, when he was talking about his second coming, he says, no one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. And so he's actually saying here that he did not know when he was going to return. Now, since then, he's gone back into heaven. I'm sure right now, sitting with the Father and Holy Spirit, I'm sure today Jesus knows when he's coming. While he was here on earth, he did not know. Well, God knows everything. Yes, but again, we're told in Philippians that God emptied himself. He emptied himself of God's power, of God's glory. Even when Jesus did miracles, he wasn't doing miracles because he was God. He was doing miracles because as a human being, he was trusting in the Holy Spirit as a prophet of God, and the Holy Spirit was doing miracles through him. That's why he was able to tell his disciples, greater works than I have done, you will do. Now, as God, he could have done miracles, but he was God by identity. He had become a real human being. So he grew in knowledge. His knowledge was limited. We're also told in Luke chapter 2:52, we get a little snapshot of Jesus when he was 12 years old. It says, and Jesus grew in wisdom. Well, how can God, who could be wiser than God? How does God grow in wisdom? How does God have limited knowledge? Because God, he was by identity, but God had become a real human being.
Mm-hmm. And you've already shared with us that Jesus has been called the second Adam and a little bit about that, but there are other names for him as well.
He's called the Son of Man, meaning the son of mankind, God's jump-starting and recreating the human race. He's called the first fruits of a new creation. He's called the firstborn of a new creation. And he is called in 1 Corinthians 15 and a couple of other places, the second Adam. There are some similarities between Adam and Jesus. Both were born without a sin nature. In Genesis 1, when God looked at everything he had made, including Adam and Eve, it says God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And evidently, the virgin birth of Jesus bypassed the sin nature, because Romans 5:12 says sin entered the world through one man. You women should like that. Sin entered the world through a man. Both were born without a sin nature. Both had the ability to sin, but did not have a sin nature, even though Adam and Eve did not have a sin nature, but they had a free will, and they were able to choose to sin, and they did sin. They were tempted to sin, even though they didn't have a sin nature, they sinned. Jesus was tempted to sin, even though he didn't have a sin nature, but he did not sin. Now, we looked at these verses last week, Dana, but they apply here again, Hebrews 4:5. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet without sin. And also Hebrews 12:17-18. For this reason, he had to be made like his brothers in every way in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might make atonement for the sins of the people, because he himself suffered when he was tempted. He is able to help those who are being tempted. So the resurrected Jesus becomes what Adam and Eve were, immortal. They chose to sin. They developed a sin nature. They became mortal. Jesus, God emptied, was born mortal, chose not to sin, and in his resurrection from the dead became immortal. He's kind of a carbon copy or first fruits for the rest of us. Through the second Adam, the world's going to be recreated. We're going to return to Eden. Like we mentioned, Eden, paradise, heaven, all different ways of saying the same thing. I will not be with you next week. I'll be out of town. The Bob Siegel Show will air. We will have a choice repeat for you. I'll be back for a brand spanking new live show 2 weeks from now.
Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.